Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us on Relational Practice, the Social Work Podcast. I'm Dr. Jodie Park.
And I'm Rose Mackey. And we're both private practice social workers here in New South Wales, Australia, working in the fields of child protection, out-of-home care and trauma. And we're recording this episode on Dharawal land.
Today, we're diving into the world of informal assessments and the everyday observations that inform our understanding of parenting capacity. So we're still in our kind of assessing parenting capacity. I was thinking saga, but what's the word?
Series.
Series is much better than saga. Series, yes. So last episode, we talked about kind of fundamentals around parenting capacity assessing, why you do it, how you do it, kind of what's important.
Yep.
Today, we're going to talk a little bit about informal assessments. And before those of you who are kind of who never do parenting capacity assessments switch off, I just want you to remember what we said last time, which is that everybody does some assessing of people in, if you're a social work practitioner, you're doing assessment of people.
Or even just working in the welfare field.
Yeah, that's right. Or working in the welfare field. Yeah. So the skills that we talk about, whilst we may relate them to parenting capacity and assessing, they're actual skills that you can use in every practice setting.
Yes. And we did talk a lot last episode about why it's important, and it's really those long-term consequences and impacts, you know, in society and on individuals. A lot of those consequences or impacts come from the way you parent it, so it is super important, we think, when working with any individual, if they're in a family context, which is a lot of people,
yeah,
that we all have, you know, an awareness and some skills and capabilities around parenting capacity and how to make sense of what you're seeing and also how to then address it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because informal assessing really is trying to work out what it is that you're looking at any given time.
Mm.
So it is that sense making,
yeah,
isn't it? And that's what we're talking about. It's about the observations that are occurring because you're interacting with somebody else. So that's what informal assessment really means.
And then it may not mean it's your role to do anything per se in relation to that parenting capacity, but working in a multidisciplinary team,
mm-hmm.
it may be a referral option or a conversation with a colleague around, this is what I've seen, this is what I was thinking, and given it's in your domain, I'm passing the information on to you. It might be as, you know, that's the extent of your role, but there's still a role to play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. So before we kind of have our conversation about informal assessments, can we just do a bit of a shout out for all of the places, I think, that are listening to us at the moment? It's crazy.
It's blown us away, hasn't it?
It really has. It's crazy. So we have listeners from lots of different places in Australia, from New South Wales, from Western Australia, from
ACT,
from Tasmania.
Victoria.
And from Victoria, that's right. Did I say Sydney?
Well, we said New South Wales.
Okay, yeah. Also from, we have listeners from Israel.
Which, hello to you guys over there.
Absolutely.
So exciting that you're listening.
Yep, in Singapore.
Yep.
A few different places in the USA.
Which my paternal grandmother was American, so that kind of tickles my fancy, can I say?
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Lots of different places in the UK.
Yeah, and Germany.
And Germany. And
in Vienna?
Yes, and in Austria and Vienna.
In Austria, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy that all of you are listening to us. So
we appreciate it, and we hope that you are enjoying listening and maybe having a laugh with us or at us, mm-hmm. and, you know, maybe, you know, taking away something from the episode so far.
Yeah. And as always, please connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. Please email any practice stories. We'd love to hear your practice stories, or email any questions, or just really just email us relationalpractice01 or lowercase@gmail.com.
Yeah, we'd love to connect in more ways than just the podcast.
All right. Okay, let's get on to informal assessments. So when I think about this, when we were doing our planning about informal assessing, I was thinking, okay, well, how do we talk about skills, the skills that you use when you're informally assessing a situation or a person? And I guess we both kind of landed on really talking about observational skills.
Yes.
Yeah. And what they actually are. Like, what is it that you're observing? Because that's kind of what you're, that's how you're going to understand what it is that you're looking at, as we said before, because really it's about a sense-making process.
Mm. Yeah. So can we just maybe even step back? The informal bit,
yeah.
Informal part of assessment, what that means for us is everyday observation. So this is not particularly when you're asked to go and do a formal parenting capacity assessment, or perhaps, you know, you're sitting down to do it, a different type of assessment. It's about your everyday interactions with your clients and making sense of what you're seeing and understanding what that is, and then using that information to either inform a formal assessment or inform your casework or your intervention.
Yeah, so good, Rose. I'm so glad you said that, because I think I was trying to fumble that, but actually, yes, 100%. That's exactly what this informal assessment process is. It is those, it is what it is that you're looking at, how you can then use that information to inform future intervention.
Yes.
Or interactions. Yeah. Okay. So when you think about what you are going to be observing, and this isn't just about parenting capacity, this is about, as we said, everything, any interaction really, you're going to be observing the way that this person actually relates to you. Yeah. And also the way, if there's more than just one person, you just say it's a family group, how the family members relate to each other. So what does that interaction look like? Because that tells you a lot about what might be happening for that individual, but also
the family system.
Yeah, in the family system. You're going to be thinking about what you saw around or observe around their problem-solving skills. What did they look like? Also around their maybe emotional and behavioral regulation skills.
Definitely around that.
Absolutely. What happened when they maybe became a little bit...
aroused.
Aroused, escalated.
Escalated.
Yep. What did that look like? How long did it last for? And were they able to calm themselves? And what did the calming process look like?
And what did it look like for the other people in the room, if they're family members too? What does it look like when someone in the family is getting...
Escalated. Yeah.
What are the other people in that room? How are they reacting or acting to that situation?
Because doesn't that tell you a lot?
So much.
And, you know, we've both been in lots of situations where one person would become escalated. And even if it was just a slight heightened escalation, and you can see the other people in maybe that family system withdrawing or kind of, you know, moving back, or...
Or the people pleasing,
the people
you know,
pleasing.
That comes out, or the nurturing or compassionate side to try and de-escalate it. Oftentimes, like, you see that children doing that with their parents, trying to make it okay.
Yeah.
Make it better.
Doing the whole appeasement stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, true. You're going to observe around what happens when you set boundaries, or does the person try and set boundaries with you? What are those boundaries like, and what happens? How does that whole process happen?
Yeah.
What their communication skills are. One of the things that I'm really fascinated by when I'm doing any kind of observation of interaction is whether there's congruence between verbal and nonverbal communication. It's actually fascinating to look at that with children. Across all life ages.
Yes.
But with children, it's really interesting.
You mean parents in the observing parents with their children, or just children on their own?
Children on their own.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Because that tells you, I think, so much about how they, you know, maybe are they inhibiting their emotional responses? Yeah.
Mm.
Because they've learned that that's the way to maintain safety in their environment. Or are they really external? Or are they smiling and saying everything's fine when their face looks like they're about to cry?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's really interesting.
It is, actually.
But definitely you can also see that congruence in adults as well, you know. Are they smiling and saying everything's fine, but they actually, their face looks like thunder and they look like they could be seething and about to attack anybody, somebody at any given second?
Yeah.
Is there congruence? It's always go back to, if you're kind of working with someone and you're like, there's something a bit off about them, always go back to, okay, in your last interaction with them, was there congruence between what they were saying and how they said it? Because it tells you a lot about the person. It tells you so much about the person. All right. But you're obviously going to be trying to kind of do some observations around what the home looked like, what it smelt like. How did it feel to be in that home?
Mm.
Yeah.
And does it, if you're there over multiple visits, is it the same on the occasions you're visiting, or on the first occasion you go to observe, is it super clean?
Yeah.
And then as your observation goes on, is there a decline, I guess, in the presentation of the home, or is it just generally always the same?
Mm.
Yeah. What does it look like, and what does that mean then? How do you make sense of that?
Yeah. Yeah. I do always like to think about how it makes me feel as well.
Yeah. As in the atmosphere, yeah. Do you mean? And yeah, inviting and welcoming, or cold and, you know, yeah. Really
yeah.
Chaotic and messy and cluttered and
yeah.
Because that gives you a sense of feeling, doesn't it? Of, I want to stay here for too long.
But it also, I think, tells you a lot about what might be hidden and what might be in the open.
Yes.
Yep. And if you get a sense that there's a lot being hidden in this home environment, then what's that about?
Yeah.
It's all about curiosity. It's all about using your curiosity to inform your assessment of this person, this location, this home, whatever it is.
Yep. And it's about, as we all know, having multiple hypotheses.
Yeah.
You cannot just have one hypothesis that I'm seeing the home present in this manner, so it means this. Yeah. It's about having multiple, you know, different versions of what it could mean. And then as you continue observing and working with that person or family, gathering more information through your curiosity to rule out your hypothesis.
I was going to ask you a question about that curiosity, Rose. Do you think that is something that still is talked about in practice? You know, that notion of being curious and then using that curiosity to form hypotheses. Do you think that's something that still happens?
Well, I think it's talked about.
Yeah.
Yes. But then I think when you add in, you know, time factors, caseloads, they're like the time it takes to write, assessments, file notes, whatever it may be, attend meetings, attend trainings.
Yeah.
I do wonder, is it part of the language? And then in practice, it actually maybe isn't demonstrated as much as what you would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think about the time it takes to really be curious,
mm.
to form the relationships, to do multiple observations.
Yeah.
When you're juggling a whole lot of clients on your caseload, when you've got competing priorities such as training, you know, managing staff, resources, attending meetings, providing, you know, resources to other interagency partners, all of the things that come in a day.
Mm.
I do wonder if it's that part of the practice that often suffers the most.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder that too. And I also wonder whether it's still something that people recognise it as an important practice tool.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I was just really interested. I was curious about it.
Yeah. I often think if you have, let's say you've got 3-4 hypotheses,
mm.
and the information that you gather immediately kind of points to one hypothesis over the other. I remember myself thinking, don't stop here, because have I just gathered the information to get to this outcome?
Mm.
You know, and then
yep.
Having to need to use colleagues or supervision to really stretch myself to go back and continue to still explore the other hypotheses and to look at new information or information that maybe doesn't fit, to continue working through observation stage to get to, you know, an outcome in the assessment. I do think, though, if you get to one hypothesis quite quickly,
mm-hmm.
and you're pressured, I understand the temptation to maybe be like, well, this is what it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I know I've done that.
We've all done it.
Has it been great casework? Of course not. But have we done it? Of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember, Rose, you and I being on After Hours once,
uh-huh.
Child Protection, and we had to go out and do, it wasn't called a safety assessment then. It was, you know, there was a...
SAS 1 or 2?
Yeah, it was a SAS 2, so it was secondary assessment. And really it was looking at whether the kid was safe and what the risk factors were. And it was a father that you already knew and I knew of him. And Rose and I, we worked in different offices at that time. So the fact that I knew of him from in a different office meant that he was a really kind of violent, unsavory man. Because he was a huge, you know who I'm talking about, don't you?
I do now. When you started talking, you have such a good memory. I'm like, ooh, what's his story?
Yeah, I remember this man was so violent and there was lots of times where was your office actually put on shutdown because of him? Yeah, that's probably how I would have heard about it in a different office. And I think we went out and we did that assessment. I think he had a new baby or something. There was some reason we went out there and did this assessment.
Just luck of the draw, wasn't it, that I was on after hours that night?
I'm sure he was feeling that way too.
I'm sure he was.
And let's face it, we made that assessment suit we made the outcome suit what we needed to suit because we knew of his history.
Well, I had case managed his children and knew, you know, all the information that the agency held of him. Had got a formal assessment done of him. And, you know, we did absolutely make it suit, but I still think it was absolutely correct.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what I was kind of thinking about. I think there's always going to be those times where you won't critically reflect. You will just make the assessment or make the outcome suit what you know it has to. Mm. And are you right or are you wrong to do that? I don't know the answer to that. And I guess all you can do at any given time is just be guided by your own ethics.
Yeah.
And your own practice at that moment and make the best decisions you can make at that moment.
And the decision that we made that night, was it the best decision for that child, in my professional opinion?
Yeah.
It wasn't about me or him or
no, it wasn't
any of what we knew. It was absolutely a child-centered decision.
Yeah, definitely was. It definitely was. But other people might not have made that decision.
Oh, I mean, I didn't make the decision for his first child for so many months for many reasons.
Yeah.
Fear. How is this going to actually play out for that child, for me, for that mother?
Yeah.
There were, you know, absolutely could understand if someone else had been out in the middle of the night too.
Yeah, yeah.
To respond to that family.
Yeah.
That other decisions would have been far easier and safer to make. And I understand that completely because I did that for months with his first child.
It was crazy response too. I just remember there were lots of police, there were lots of guns.
I mean, and we're talking about a man with a very, very violent history and a mental health diagnosis, one of the ones that actually is not going to change in any, you know, time frame.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wasn't. Forgot about that.
I know. I don't know why I thought of that, but I did. I actually thought, okay. All right. So I guess maybe it might be useful to think about the questions that we ask ourselves when we're trying to critically reflect.
Well, you think, hilarious little segue, what do I already know? That's one of the first questions.
That's true.
What do you already know?
Yeah.
And for that situation, I intimately knew years worth of child protection history, recent history as well.
Yeah, you did. And I guess the fact that we were on after hours, I didn't have that intimate knowledge of him, but I knew of him. But I had, you know, I have such respect for you that I knew that if you were saying this, then there was validity to the situation. And it wasn't, you know, I just needed to run with
what I was saying. When have you ever done that?
In that situation.
That'd be the only time.
So many times I do that.
So what other questions do we ask?
I guess you always need to know what. So you're kind of thinking about what do I know, but what do I need to know?
What's going to help me
inform
myself in this situation or for this particular assessment?
Yeah.
What do I need to know?
And the next thing that I always ask myself is it what I know, is it actually fact or is it my own opinion?
Or an opinion of others.
Yes.
That sometimes is tricky to figure out what is factually correct of other services information versus an opinion.
That's so true. Yeah. I also, because I'm always big on being able to back everything up. So every decision I make, every recommendation I make, I always try and think about, okay, well, what evidence do I use to support this? What do I know that supports the decision or the recommendation I'm making?
Do you need a dossier of supporting information, or is it just one or two? I'm asking because sometimes I make recommendations and then I've got 17 points about why I'm making this recommendation. And I think, what are you doing? Who's reading this? You don't need to always provide, especially if it's in an assessment, it's already in there, the information. I just don't know why I need to continuously link kind of to make the point. Probably says more about me than anything else.
I guess, you know, I don't know. I guess sometimes I see it as helping the whoever's reading this report to understand quickly. To link it really quickly. Look, I'm just going to say this. Sometimes I think some people don't read things. And I think that, you know, and I'm guilty of this at times as well. If you're skimming, are you going to miss stuff?
Yeah. Absolutely. Especially you think of some of the reports you get that are, you know, 70 pages long.
Yeah.
Takes a lot of time to read those.
Yeah.
So it is beneficial to link a recommendation and provide the evidence. But yeah. I do think sometimes we don't need as much as what we give either, if it's in the body.
Yeah.
Just as long as you
depends.
Can.
Maybe it just depends on what type of decision or recommendation you're making and whether it is backed up by a report or whether it's something else.
And I guess if they're not going to get it, then you do need to link it very well and holistically why.
But we all, I would think anyone that practices in this community services field, this global field of community services, would know people that just do not get it.
I would agree. So other things you might be curious about is what is the stated and unstated assumptions in the information?
Yeah.
So an example of that might be, I don't know what it looks like across other jurisdictions, but in New South Wales, when the police have any interactions with an individual, they make what's called an event and it goes on the system. So you might have no criminal history. So you've never been found guilty of an offence, but you might have 78 events, 78 different interactions with the police.
Yeah.
That might show you or show the reader, the worker, a pattern history of, you know, either being an alleged perpetrator of violence or, you know, hanging out with really antisocial people that are often picked up and interviewed for crimes. So what's stated, I guess, or what the assumptions you make in that information, you know, you can take a lot from those events around the type of people that they're interacting with, especially if you think about violence and sexual assault. We know that a lot of perpetrators aren't actually ever convicted. So there's no criminal history, but what does the events tell you? And then what are the, you know, often unstated assumptions you can draw from that?
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And it may not be factual because there's no proven conviction, but then I would still use that information to inform my assessment and become curious around asking lots of different questions around the use of either violence or past relationships and why they've ended and, you know, maintaining contact with people in past relationships or not.
So you would use that information to inform or make a hypothesis around what might be occurring.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. And then you would look for evidence to test that hypothesis.
Yes.
Yeah.
And structure questions as well as my observations of that person and their relationships. I would structure questions around how am I going to elicit some information to continue testing my hypotheses, and then who else might I need to talk to?
Yeah. And I guess as part of testing that hypothesis, you're going to be thinking about, is there another way I can think about this information?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because that might form a different hypothesis. Yeah.
Especially when the information maybe doesn't fit what you've already found and what you're thinking.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's easy to dismiss one piece of information if it doesn't kind of fit with what you've got. And I think those times when you really need to stop and think about, what am I missing or what other ways can I be thinking about this? Or is there a different hypothesis I haven't actually considered?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the most important things that you need to be thinking about is what you're bringing to this whole process. So what's your own story? What's your own biases? You know, what's your own personal viewpoint, and how is your personal response impacting or influencing your professional response? Yeah, because there is always going to be an impact. It's just about what, you know, are you aware of what that is?
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you mitigate, you know, if you have a particular bias about what it is that you're seeing or you're hearing or you're interacting with or feeling, can you kind of mitigate the impact of that bias in some way by just having some insight about the fact that you have a bias?
Mm. Biases, they fascinate me. But what I'm more consciously concerned about in my own practice is my blind spots. Mm. My blind spots in my practice, but also my blind spots in my biases.
Yeah, true. Oh, that's deep.
Mm.
How do you know what your blind spots are in your biases?
Well, you don't. That's the whole worry around it. You know, I can recall a number of supervisions that I've asked my supervisors or people I'm supervising, where do you think my blind spots are in practice, and where do you think my blind spots are in my values and my biases? Because I'm not going to know them, am I? Because they wouldn't be hidden.
Has anyone actually answered that question?
I mean, I can remember one amazing manager casework. At the time, I was her manager. She was like, oh, well, I know where this is going. And I was like, where? And she's like, you're going to ask me to ask my staff about. And I was like, well, I hadn't thought about that, but absolutely a great point. But I don't know how you overcome your blind spots. And I do think the power of observation, it's a skill that we utilize in this field of practice. And our colleagues must be also observing me at times, and they would absolutely have seen things that I don't know. And I would really love that feedback because then it's not hidden, and then it's something I can be conscious of, and it's only going to inform my practice and make me a better practitioner.
What if there is nothing hidden?
I mean, it's possible. That's possible too, but it's just a question I think I often have asked over the years and continue to think about myself when I'm reflecting, what am I missing about myself?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Because, I mean, I tend to think we all have hidden stuff. Like, I do actually agree with you. But then as you were talking, I was thinking, but maybe we don't. And maybe that's a bias we have by making an assumption that we're hiding something. This is why this is deep. It's like a rabbit hole.
I know. Well, if anyone's got any answers, suggestions, theories, please email me and Jody and let us know, because, yeah, it's kind of like that, you know, those questions, what is the meaning of life and where do the mermaids stand?
Mm.
It's one of those questions I've added to that. Like,
and I think sometimes we'll never know the answers to that stuff. And I wonder if that's okay that we don't know, because maybe the fact that we try and practice from a position of curiosity, of insight, and also knowing that we're going to have good days and bad days, maybe that's enough. I don't know. I don't know if it's enough or not, but I guess maybe that's what I try and tell myself, that, you know, you're not always going to be, you know, 200% on, and that's okay. But if you're not on, what does that look like to the person you're working with?
Yeah. Especially if you're working in like a crisis or, you know, very fast turnover, so it's not a long-term relationship. Those days where you're not on, I wonder more about those days too.
I mean, I think about it in therapy though.
Yep.
You know, if I'm not having a good day and I've got this person sitting across from me who's really vulnerable and talking about things that are really important to them, you know, I owe it to be on. I owe it to them to be on.
But you're not a robot. You are a human being. And I have seen you postpone or reschedule appointments when you're absolutely nowhere near the window of tolerance you need to be.
That's true. I've
seen you do that. But I guess when you're saying, you're not on, like, is it a slight variance to normal, probably, for you, as opposed to you're disastrously outside of that window of tolerance?
That's true. Maybe that's where my bias is. Maybe I wouldn't know if I was like disastrously outside it. Maybe I would never know.
Ooh.
I'd just be living life in chaos.
And you're not, so therefore you know.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, I'm going to talk about a practice story, and I'm going to try and illustrate how I've synthesized documentation, personal narratives, and observations to make sense of a mother's parenting capacity. So it's about how the informal and the formal kind of assessment process works together to give recommendations, really, about the mother's parenting capacity.
And also her motivation for change.
Definitely her motivation for change, yeah. All right, so just a little bit about the context. So this was a single mum. She had two children. She had a daughter aged 3 and a son aged 2. The mother had a history of drug use. She had told different workers in her life at the time that she had stopped her use, but she hadn't told that to all the workers. It was just a select few. She also had a history of being victimized by men and had been in multiple unsafe relationships. And we know that, you know, the mum could never be held responsible for the actions of the men in her life at that time. But the fact that the children were exposed to domestic violence really increased the child protection concerns for them. Yeah. The children at the stage when I became involved, the children had been in out-of-home care for 2 months. So really early on, really in the process.
Yeah. And they're really little too.
They're really little, yeah. It was their first entry into formal out-of-home care, although they had actually been out of their mum's care off and on for significant parts of their life, and they'd always gone to stay with their grandparents, but it was an informal arrangement. Okay. Their children have no contact with their paternal family, and they actually have different paternal families, and neither child has any contact with them. The information from the mum's counsellor, so she had trauma-focused counselling. So the information from that counsellor was that mum was really highly motivated to have her children restored. She was no longer in a relationship, so no longer in a violent relationship. She had stopped her drug use. She was the person that was really clear that mum had stopped all drug use. She said that mum was really well engaged in trauma counselling, but also really engaged in drug and alcohol and was really committed to parenting her children drug-free. So that's the information I gained from her. So when I, you know, sorry, I should have said that, I kind of spoke to the counsellor, got mum's permission to speak to the counsellor, because it's always good to get that external viewpoint into what is might be happening for the person that you are doing the assessment on. I also spoke to drug and alcohol, and this was a little bit different because I actually didn't get mum's consent to speak to the drug and alcohol person because mum said no. And the reason I did is because this was a assessment for children's court.
Right.
And so the children were in statutory care.
And terms of reference, I'm assuming, would have indicated that you needed to talk to them.
That's right. Yeah.
So best practice to seek consent.
Yeah.
She's not given it. However, given your terms of reference and the scope of work you were asked to undertake, you still had to go and speak to them.
And she would have agreed to those terms of reference because it was an agreement by all the parties of the children's court matter.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was kind of interesting because talking to the drug and alcohol worker was a very different story. So she said mum was not engaged at all. In her mind, mum was still using. And she also alluded to the fact that mum was in a new relationship. So we now have...
What do you mean alluded?
She said, can't be sure.
Right.
But I do think that mum's in a relationship now with somebody. Don't know anything more than that.
Okay.
So maybe more than alluded.
Yeah, I'd say more than alluded.
But she wasn't sure. So that was kind of interesting. That was like a little curiosity, a little hypothesis to put there to kind of suss that out a little bit.
Absolutely. I'm even curious as to the worker's motivation for sharing that with you.
Yeah,
I think sometimes when you have a gut feeling or you have a sense of something and you're working maybe not directly with children and young people, but we know child protection is everyone's business.
Yeah.
I'd like to think her motivation may have been,
yeah,
I'm passing it on just so you can be curious or not, but yeah, I'm sharing it. You do with this what you will.
Yeah, true. I guess the really interesting fact is that we now have three versions,
yes,
of the truth. Because I'd already spoken to mum once before I talked to the counsellor. So we've got mum's version, we've got this, you know, mum's trauma counsellor's version, and we've got the drug and alcohol counsellor's version of of what is truth.
Yep.
Yep. Which is kind of interesting. All up, I spent about 6 hours with Mum doing interviews with her across 3 different home visits. And I always like to do interviews, and I know you do as well, Rose, across different time periods, because then you can actually see if there is a difference. It's part of that observation.
Absolutely. Yeah. So good. As difficult as it is for the person you're assessing or working with to do it at the most chaotic time of their day.
Yeah.
That gives you a different insight versus, you know, maybe the time when the child's asleep or they're at school and there's been a period of calmness.
Mm-hmm.
You need to see, I think, the different parts of people's day.
Yeah, true. True, absolutely. I also spent for at least 4 hours interviewing the grandparents, speaking to the child protection caseworker, speaking to the children's preschool. So I got more information from different people again. And then I also spent 2 hours in the home observing birth family contact between mum and the children.
In the mum's home.
In the mum's home.
Okay.
Which was interesting.
That is interesting because often it's at a park or at a contact centre, but I think it is when you can actually see it in the home that maybe they'll be restored to.
Yes.
Very different experience often.
Yeah. And I think that's a case by case decision.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things you have to think about when you make that decision to bring children back into this home.
It's not always safe.
It's not always safe.
Emotionally or physically, hopefully, you know, but it's not always safe. It's not always possible. And it's not always in the children's best interest.
No.
Is it?
No.
So you do have to think about why and what is the impact and whose needs are we meeting if we're going to do this.
Absolutely. In this situation, it was the best decision I could have made because that contact in that home environment actually gave so much rich observational data. Like, it was quite amazing. One of the things to mention before I talk about that contact, though, before I talk about what Mum said and then I'll talk about the contact, is that during one of the interviews with Mum, a random man just arrived at the house, let himself in.
Hello.
Seemed shocked to see that Mum was with somebody else. She looked like she was about to, shit herself. I was trying to think of a better word. I couldn't. She looked a little shocked about the whole scenario. Very quickly told me this was her friend and neighbour. He looked like he was very comfortable in the home, went and made himself a cuppa, went upstairs, didn't see him again, but knew he was in the house. Asked mum, who was that person? He was just my neighbour. He's just a friend. He was a very familiar friend for the house. That's all I'm saying.
And given she had company and he's a neighbour, if you live next door, just pop back into your home, you'll see me leave and you can come back and have your cuppa.
That's true. I since found out that his name was Max. Mum didn't tell me that, but I found that out during the birth family contact, because the oldest child walked in the house and immediately said to Mum, "Where's Max?"
Is he upstairs or is he next door?
I don't know. I don't think Max did live next door, to be fair. I think Max lived with Mum. All right. So in my conversations with Mum, she was so very interesting. She was a woman who she presented so well. She was really nicely spoken. She looked just, you know, really put together. Yep. She kind of knew when to play a victim, when to play kind of a more assertive role in communication. She was someone who could really mold and morph themselves into being what the audience expected her to be. She was very relatable. She was very personable.
Mm-hmm.
I can absolutely understand why people would believe every word that she said, because she's very good at manipulating relationships. But one of the things about Mum that I found out in the interview is that there was often no substance to what she would say. She's one of 5 siblings. She's the only person in that family that actually has made choices that weren't the best choices for her to make. Everybody else in that family was very accomplished. Everyone else in that family was just kind of normal, like living their life, had no child protection intervention, had nothing. It was a very middle-class family as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the grandparents said that she'd always been a little bit different. I think she's probably got an undiagnosed mental health issue, a personality disorder of some sort.
Yeah.
That made her functioning or made her interactions with others very different. That's what I think. I think she was probably the odd one out in the family because I do think she probably has some kind of personality, undiagnosed personality disorder. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything. She was very consistent in being victimized. Everything was about how people had kind of harmed her.
And systems as well?
Systems is everything.
Everything, yep.
Everything. And, you know, if you were to listen to her, she's just this very defenseless kind of vulnerable person who's just tried to kind of make her way in the world and everyone's been out to get her.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, if you think about the other information that has been written about her, and we know that this is not always true, but you do have to consider it. And I'm thinking particularly of the police reports and the child protection reports. And there is a lot of information that paints her in a very different way, that paints her as an aggressor, that paints her as someone who threatens neighbours and threatens people that kind of, you know, don't do what she wants them to do, that yells and screams and threatens to kill her children, that threatens to stab people in the street because they've crossed her in some way.
Right.
See what I mean?
Yep.
That other documentation painted her in a very different way than the way that she painted herself.
Yeah.
Which meant that I was going into the birth family contact observation with lots and lots of different information and conflicting information about who this person was.
Mm.
So the birth family contact, 2 hours, the kids were dropped off at the home by grandparents who did not come in. Mum met them at the car, walked the children in. I was standing outside to watch the interaction. The kids already knew me. I'd already gone and introduced myself at their grandparents' home because I'd also observed them in their home environment. But they did not want to leave grandma. She eventually got them inside the house. She did as I would have done. You know, she bribed them with, you know,
food. I would. Food and games or toys.
Absolutely. She got them inside the house. Once in the house, though, it was so interesting to watch the interactions. As I said, the oldest one walked in and said, "Where's Max?" Mum didn't know what to say to that. She just kind of tried to kind of fluff it over, you know. And this child looked really confused about the fact that Max wasn't there. She actually was out trying to find Max.
So did these children have unsupervised contact in the home?
Yes.
That was their contact regime? Yes. Okay.
Weekly unsupervised contact in the home.
Yeah.
So no one really knew what was going on for these children. That changed after this interaction.
I'm sure it did.
All right. So after Mom kind of got the oldest one to forget about Max, to just kind of, you know, let's just have this visit, it was then kind of interesting to watch how she interacted with both children. She basically ignored the younger one. She basically ignored that one and just focused on the older one. So the 2-year-old.
The son.
Yeah.
She's focused on the daughter.
She's focused on the daughter. Yeah. To the point where she had gifts for one child, not for the other.
Was it birthday, Christmas, or Easter, or a special occasion?
It was no special occasion. She just had gifts for one and not the other. The younger child then, I don't know if it was in relation to the gifts, probably, because if it were me, I'd be pretty upset and confused as to why I'm not getting a gift. Anyway, kind of went out of his way then to be a little bit challenging. I would say this is probably the way that the child always interacts with mum. So the 2-year-old went around the house, started pushing things over, started, you know, clearly pushing mum's buttons, not intentionally, just being a 2-year-old, as we said before. Mum was getting more and more escalated, getting more and more angry.
How could you tell?
Her voice was rising. The way that she was communicating became very, very short, very, very, very targeted. and focused. But what she did was that she started really denigrating that 2-year-old to the 3-year-old. So it was very much about aligning that oldest child with her at the expense of the youngest one. So she would say things like, oh my God, he's just so naughty, isn't he? He's so naughty. Don't you think he's naughty? You know, things like that. Yeah. It was really concerning to watch. Neither child went to mum for affection at all during the 2 hours. If they needed help with opening things, say for a snack, they came to me or they went to each other. They did not go to mum at all. Neither child approached her for anything, basically. She was just kind of there. She interacted with them, with the 2-year-old, it was all negative interaction. With the 3-year-old, it was almost suffocating in the way that she interacted.
So earlier you had said that she, and I hope this doesn't throw you off your track, but she met her parents at the car who had the children, and there was no interaction between the mother and her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's also not interacting with her children.
Yeah.
I find that curious.
Yeah.
And her parents, you said earlier,
yeah,
had often had the children pre-removal and spent lots of time parenting their grandchildren.
Yeah.
And mum wasn't clearly parenting them full-time prior to removal.
Yeah. She blamed them for the children being removed. In her mind, it was the grandparents' fault. She believes that the grandparents were the ones that told child protection about what was going on in the home. She believes that it was all lies. In her mind, there were no concerns that warranted the removal. And she could not get past the fact that her children, and they were her children, she had lots of ownership to those children, even the ones she clearly didn't like, the younger one, were not in her care, and that wasn't a decision that she made.
Right. Whereas the informal arrangements were decisions she was able to make, and obviously the grandparents were just very willing.
Yeah.
Yeah, to meet those needs.
The grandparents were really frustrated and upset about the whole thing. They could not understand how it could be 3 years on from the birth of the oldest child, and they were still in this cycle.
Right.
They were really actually happy that Child Protection had stepped in because they'd wanted them to step in.
Well, it kind of takes the onus off them as decision makers or just passengers, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So during a contact, the youngest one looked under the lounge and came up with a vial of injecting water. And I knew it was injecting water because it was a vial of water. And I looked at the label and it actually said injecting water or vial for injection or something like that. I can't remember now what it said. Mum again looked like she was about to have a panic attack. She just grabbed it and we all pretended it didn't happen. But I did ask her about that in the next interview because I saw her one more time.
So let me ask, did she have diabetes?
No, she didn't have diabetes.
Okay.
No. The other thing that happened is that Mum's phone rang and she had contacts where she'd assigned photos and a name, and up pops one of the dads, the dad of the 2-year-old. The oldest kid actually grabbed the phone and said, yay, dad's calling, and proceeded to have a big chat to dad. Even though it wasn't his dad, this child calls this dad, yeah. Dad.
Was contact with the dad an issue? Like, were they meant
to be
there?
There was no contact because of his violence.
Oh, okay.
Clearly, there was a lot of contact that happened during those unsupervised visits. Yeah. Mum tried to stop the phone call. She was very flustered. It was the children were not having it. They had their conversation with Dad during that time. Whenever the house, by the end of the contact, the house was getting quite dirty, and the 3-year-old actually went, got the vacuum out and started to actually start vacuuming the floor.
Oh, that actually breaks my heart.
It was...
You're there observing contact, uh-huh, and you're actually just seeing play out.
Yeah.
Probably a very typical, yeah, interaction between this mother and her 2 children.
Yeah, there were no words spoken. The little one saw the mess on the floor, went and got the vacuum, started vacuuming. Mum did not stop that. Mum did not know enough to know that that actually wasn't okay. So I guess when I put all that information together, all those interviews, all that information, all that kind of stuff that I had observed, you know, my recommendation was that there was no capacity for mum to parent these children at that stage. And I did not actually think that she was motivated for change either, because she didn't think there needed to be any change. In her mind, she was fine. In her mind, it was everybody else that was the problem. Mm. She knew no reason why those children, she could not articulate what the child protection concerns were. Even though they'd been clearly documented in court documents, she was unable to articulate it.
Can I ask then, why is she telling her counsellor that she's not on drugs and she's, you know, striving for abstinence? And why is she telling her, I guess, therapeutic person that?
I think it's because that was the expectation. That was the audience.
Yeah.
And the fact that she wasn't in a relationship. They were the things that she was telling this counsellor, because that's what that counsellor wanted to hear.
Yeah. And I think you said in one of our previous episodes about oftentimes what you find difficult is when you're working with someone and you only have kind of their narrative. And so that the counsellor's only got this mum's narrative. She doesn't have the benefit of the police reports.
Of course not.
And so you can see when she's giving you her kind of interview.
Yeah.
Her narrative, it does fit mum's because that's all she's got to go on.
Yeah.
But it's curious that she knows enough that drugs and alcohol and violent relationships are a problem, but she can't even then articulate it to you.
No. Because I don't think she knew, she actually did see them as a problem. She was just meeting the expectations of the relationship with the counselor.
Yeah.
And with me, she wanted to show me that she was actually the parent that she told me she was. So even when I talked to her after the contact and we talked about how the contact went, in her mind it was fine. It was fine. She didn't know where that vial of water came from. I think she tried to gloss over that very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly. And it's just about denial. And her first port of call, really, in terms of defending herself, is always about denial.
Yeah.
So you can't promote change if you don't think there's anything to change.
Well, we know about the cycle of change, and if there's not an acknowledgement of an issue, you can't change anything.
No, you can't. You can't. And she in her mind didn't have any issues.
Yeah.
And I do think one of the first recommendations I made is that she really needed to have a thorough mental health assessment, and that child protection needed to fund that so that it was with a psychiatrist, so that it could be timely and it could be comprehensive, because there was clearly an underlying mental health disorder that really impacted on her functioning.
Yeah.
The way that she saw things, the way that she interpreted information, her cognitive functioning.
Can I ask, was she young?
Yeah.
This year.
Yeah, she was. She was kind of mid-20s.
Yeah. And I guess you can kind of see how she's got some behaviours that mask that personality, you know, the sweet voice and the, you know, playing who she thinks people want her to be, the therapist, the drug and alcohol counsellor, you to an extent. She can mask those things. But when she's in conflict or she's in chaos, and those other reports from police or child protection that show a different side, that's kind of when the mask is off, isn't it?
Because
you're disorganized in your presentation and your thoughts and you're chaotic and you're just probably reacting too, but there's no mask there. You're not holding anything at bay.
And I also think it's because when people don't react to her the way that she just expects them to, because in her mind this is the way they should react to her, it just really makes her angry. And I think the youngest child in particular makes her angry. Because there's no relationship there. So in terms of that youngest child in particular, that child was actually very much at risk of being physically harmed by this mum, because you could just imagine her escalating to the point of lashing out. Because she threatened to lash out.
Well, she threatened to kill the kids.
She threatened to kill them, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was her nurture of the children like?
There was no nurturing.
Like, I know you said they didn't go to her, but did she try and initiate it?
No, she didn't. She didn't really. No, that's not fair. She did, actually. She tried. But it looked like such a clumsy try, and it looked so foreign to the children that it was kind of, like, awkward.
Right.
It was like they looked at her and she looked at them and nobody really knew what to do.
Mm.
Yeah.
Awkward's a good word then for that.
It was really confusing for the kids, and it was really kind of confronting to watch that interaction. Yeah.
So how did you, I guess, narrow down that what you were seeing was confusion as opposed to the way in which they receive nurture or touch or whatever it might have been?
I mean, the fact is that was my word that I interpreted this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But what I had seen of these children in a different care context with their grandparents was very different to what I was seeing now in terms of their ability to accept and initiate affection.
Right.
So that's why it's important to see kids in two different contexts, isn't it? Because you always see a difference.
Yes.
So with the grandparents, very affectionate. Very affectionate.
And I don't know if you would recall this, but you said you spoke to the childcare centers. Did they have, what was their kind of observation of the children in that environment? Were they very independent and do it myself or accepting of, you know, childcare workers' assistance?
They were more independent than accepting.
Yeah.
Of assistance from, it was also a new arrangement.
Right.
So they had not been to childcare before during the informal periods of care. They'd only just started, I think, a month prior.
Yeah, okay.
And they were, they were quite hesitant to engage the childcare worker, which kind of fitted with the way that they engaged with mum.
It also fits their age of development with a stranger.
Yeah, it does.
As well.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Look, I hope that was useful. I feel like I went on a lot, Rose. I hope it was useful just to kind of think about how you can actually gain information from multiple sources and how you're really using your own practice skills to know what to look at and then to make sense of what you're looking at.
Yeah. I guess my last question I would have would be around your biases in that assessment.
Yeah.
And where they sat, I guess, when you wrote it up formally.
Yeah, look, it was kind of interesting because I felt really sad in particular for that youngest child.
Yeah.
For both children, of course, but for that youngest child. And I guess when I was, it took me a little bit of thinking time to be able to write the assessment up in a way that didn't come across as blaming of the mum in terms of the way that she treated that youngest child because it was really hard to watch.
Yeah.
So I needed to reflect on the way that I was feeling. I needed to set it aside for a bit and then I needed to write it and then I needed to edit it to make sure that I was actually being fair. I went back to my questions. You know, the beginning of this podcast, we kind of gave those kind of critical reflection questions. I went back to those questions. And one of the questions I actually added was, am I being fair in what I am saying?
I really like that because we've said, and we'll always say, we always bring a bias.
Yeah.
But I could tell when you were re-narrating that practice example that there was, you know, this feeling around particularly the youngest child.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really helpful that you shared how you manage that bias or any other bias, but that thinking time and going back to your questions and adding a question, am I being fair? I'm sure there's pieces of work we've both written that it has blame in it. But I really like the practical strategy we can all take away from this is setting it aside, adding in a question and always remembering, am I being fair? And how does it land and read for another party? Because what we never want to do is actually be blaming in our practice.
No, never, never. And I mean, sometimes we are, let's face it. Sometimes we are, but you know, you try and mitigate that as much as you possibly can.
I think there is the difference between accountability and blame
and
blaming just because our bias is that this isn't how you treat a little two-year-old boy or whatever the bias may be, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a difference in how do we actually write reports for people to take accountability for their actual choices and their actions or inactions in relation mm-hmm. to their parenting.
Yeah, I agree. But if I think about a different practice scenario and I think just say you're having a conversation with somebody and I would know for sure that just say I was having a conversation with maybe a foster carer who I, in my mind, has treated a child pretty poorly.
Yeah.
I would be 100% certain that there would be some kind of blame in maybe the way that I approached that conversation. Unless I pulled it back quick enough.
Well, I would say to that then, there's a difference between blame and shame.
Yeah, maybe true. Yeah,
and so blame and accountability versus blame and shaming just because, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Combo for another day, but blame and shame are different things. But as adults in a parenting world, we need to take accountability for our actions or inactions. And how you take accountability is oftentimes people pointing out there's a problem.
Yeah.
And sometimes it may look like blame because sometimes that's the communication style. I don't know.
Look, I have, just to end this, because yeah, it is for a different day, but I just want to kind of add to that, that there's one particular scenario that I can think of in my brain where I was having a conversation with a carer and I realized how I was sounding and I actually stopped and apologized because I needed to.
Yeah.
Because what the way that I was bringing my own personal views and opinions into this situation.
Yeah.
So I needed to stop and I needed to apologize for that. And that's kind of the way that I managed that.
Yeah.
We then agreed to clean slate it and we started the conversation again.
I love it.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that.
No, that's okay, because it wasn't my best practice moment.
We've all been there. Absolutely all been there. But I do think there's a difference between blame and shame, and there does need to be accountability, you know, for the way we parent children.
I feel like that's a topic, blame and shame. I love it.
Blame and shame.
All right.
All right. Okay. Well, hopefully we have talked enough to provide, I guess, examples of how when you're assessing parenting capacity, the function is to consider what are the current risks alongside a parent's understanding mm-hmm. and their acknowledgement and demonstrated capacity and motivation to mitigate those risks in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now and in the future, and to promote a safe environment for their children. That's yep. kind of like the summary, I guess, of parenting capacity.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of Relational Practice, a Social Work Podcast. To ensure you don't miss future discussions relevant to your practice, including our next fortnight's episode, which will be on formal parenting capacity assessments, please hit that follow button. Subscribe to our social media and let other social workers know where to find us. Until then, stay safe and continue to practice relationally. Bye, guys.